directly through forms of support that include membership. We're trying to get from half of 1% to 1%. If we can get to 1% financial support, we are completely insulated indefinitely from any financial calamities such as those we've experienced in the past. So the membership support is a really big deal. Consider signing up at joinpacman.com. You'll get instant access to the bonus show, which, by the way, if you're a member, you can listen to or watch right now.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT in sound from way out.
Folks, glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet, because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Well, welcome, everybody. The honeymoon is over and there is trouble in paradise. Donald Trump apparently already hates his new criminal lawyer and is reportedly furious with him, wondering aloud, Why am I paying so much for this legal defense? This is, of course, relating to Trump's first of four criminal trials. This is all about Todd Blanche, Trump's criminal defense attorney. The New York Times has a very good article on this from a couple days ago. Trump venting about lawyer in his criminal trial seeks more aggression. Todd Blanche upended his career to represent Trump and has been the former president's favorite. But Mr. Trump has made him a focus of his episodic rash. We'll link to the article, but the number of things that Trump is displeased with is growing very quickly. Number one, behind closed doors and in phone calls, Trump.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
If you're watching this pre-recorded report, then Al Jazeera has been banned in the territory of Israel.
As the death toll in Gaza approaches 35,000, Israeli authorities take Al Jazeera off the air in Israel and order Palestinians in eastern Rafah to evacuate ahead of an Israeli offensive. We'll go to Doha to speak with Al Jazeera's managing editor, Mohammed Mourwan. And as the World Food Program warns northern Gaza is experiencing full-blown famine, we'll get an update from Dr. Waleed Wasoud of the Palestine Children's Relief Fund in Amman. He's just returned from a medical mission in Gaza. Then graduation ceremonies begin on college campuses across the United States as students continue their protests calling for their schools to divest from Israel.
I apologize that this is not a typical graduation speech, but there is nothing typical about the times that we are living in. There is nothing typical about 15,000 children live-streamed deaths being watched. And there is nothing acceptable about our institutional complicity, silence, or the gross misuse of police force nationwide.
We'll speak with a senior who is part of the graduation protest at the University of Michigan, and we'll go to the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. In 2017, neo-Nazis chanted, "Jews will not replace us there." We'll speak with a UVA student arrested Saturday after police and riot gear stormed a Gaza Solidarity encampment. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's ordered 100,000 Palestinians living in eastern Rafah to evacuate ahead of an Israeli offensive on the southern Gaza city, where more than 1.4 million displaced Palestinians have sought refuge. The UN aid agency, UNRWA, warned Israel's attack on Rafah would have devastating consequences and lead to more civilian suffering and deaths. Overnight, Israeli bombardments killed at least 26 people in Rafah, including 11 children.
We fled death and destruction, and we came to Rafah only to find destruction here. Do they want to kill us here? We came seeking safety in Rafah. Where do they want to send us? Where are we to go? The situation is so difficult. We're unable to describe the destruction that we are living in here. Someone feel for us and the tragedy we are living through.
The order to evacuate Rafah came a day after Hamas fighters fired rockets at the Karam Abu Salem crossing, killing four Israeli soldiers. This all comes as ceasefire talks appear to have stalled. On the humanitarian front, Cindy McCain, the widow of Senator John McCain, now the head of the World Food Program, told NBC that northern Gaza is in full-blown famine.
What I can explain to you is that there is famine, full-blown famine in the north, and it's moving its way south.
We'll speak to a doctor who just left Gaza about the full-blown famine. He's now in Amman. Protests continue on college campuses across the United States as students call on schools to divest from Israel. At the University of Michigan, students holding Palestinian flags briefly disrupted graduation ceremony Saturday as a plane flew overhead holding a banner that read, "Divest from Israel now, free Palestine." At Indiana University in Bloomington, some students walked out of Saturday's commencement and booed the school's president. Planes also circled above that ceremony, carrying a banner with a Palestinian flag and the words, "Let Gaza live." At the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, police arrested 25 protesters who'd set up a Gaza solidarity encampment. In Chicago, 68 people were arrested in an encampment outside the Art Institute of Chicago. New York police made 56 arrests early Friday after raiding student encampments at the New School and NYU. Riot police have also cleared a student encampment at USC, the University of Southern California. According to the Associated Press, police have now arrested more than 2,500 students at pro-Palestine protests. That includes 133 arrests on Thursday at SUNY New Paltz, at State University of New York, when police violently raided a student encampment. At the University of Mississippi, officials have opened a probe after video went viral showing a group of white counter-protesters harassing a black protester. One white student was seen imitating a monkey as he mocked her while others screamed, "Lock her up." Meanwhile, school officials at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, have reached an agreement with student protesters and have vowed to work toward divesting from, quote, companies that profit from gross human rights violations and or the occupation of Palestinian territories, unquote. Evergreen College is the alma mater of Rachel Corrie, the American peace activist killed by an Israeli military bulldozer in Gaza in 2003. In Gaza, Palestinians have voiced support for the student protests.
My message for the American students is that we are extremely proud, and their protests and their solidarity with Palestine and with Gaza gave us a glimpse of hope. And they didn't leave us left alone. They didn't leave us feeling helpless.
In Britain, solidarity encampments have also been set up on the same day at Cambridge and Oxford. In other education news, Columbia University in New York is now under a federal investigation for anti-Palestinian discrimination. The Department of Education opened the probe after the group Palestine Legal accused the school of, quote, extreme anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab and Islamophobic harassment, unquote. Israeli authorities have taken Al Jazeera off the air inside Israel. On Sunday, police officers raided the network's Jerusalem bureau, seized broadcasting equipment. Israel's Foreign Press Association called it a, quote, dark day for democracy. The move came just 2 days after World Press Freedom Day. Over the past 8 months, Al Jazeera has been one of the only international outlets with reporters on the ground inside Gaza. We'll have more on that story, speaking with the managing editor of Al Jazeera in Doha after headlines. Tens of thousands of Israelis took to the streets Saturday in nationwide rallies calling for a deal to free the hostages and to hold early elections in Israel. Danny Elgart, whose brother is being held in Gaza, addressed the protest in Tel Aviv.
Bibi, we call you to reach a ceasefire deal which secures the release of all hostages. Ceasefire that secures the release of hostages. The war actually didn't end, Bibi, but know that the war ended. You can't lie to us. You are taking more time so you and Ben-Gvir can stay in power. You are taking more time so you will stay in power. You don't care about the 133 or 132 hostages. An operation in Rafah will cause the death of the hostages. You don't have a mandate to kill 132 citizens of Israel.
In Panama, Jose Raul Mulino, a last-minute standing candidate, was declared the winner of Sunday's presidential election. Mulino, Panama's former public security minister, was originally a vice presidential candidate and was only officially announced as a presidential candidate 2 days before voting after his running mate, the former president Ricardo Martinelli, was disqualified due to a money laundering conviction. Martinelli, whose presidency ended a decade ago, has been taking refuge in the Nicaraguan embassy since February due to his legal issues. He remains popular in his has vowed to revive Panama's economy, take on drug cartels, and crack down on migration through Panama, including shutting down the treacherous Darien Gap. In southern Brazil, at least 78 people have died from major flooding after days of torrential downpours. Over 100 are still missing, and tens of thousands have been displaced in the state of Rio Grande do Sul, where a hydroelectric dam collapsed and a lake broke its bank. This is a flood survivor who works at a local health center.
Everything's lost. There's nothing complete. I've been working here in this health unit for 23 years.
Here in the U.S., much of the Houston area remains submerged after a week of heavy rains. One five-year-old child was killed when the vehicle he was riding in was swept away by fast-moving water. In other news from Texas, Democratic Congressmember Henry Cuellar and his wife were indicted on federal bribery and conspiracy charges. They're accused of accepting nearly $600,000 in bribes from an Azerbaijani oil and gas company and a bank in Mexico. Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial is entering its third week of testimony. On Friday, Trump's former top aide, Hope Hicks, described efforts to do damage control in the weeks prior to the 2016 election following the release of the infamous Access Hollywood tape where Trump openly bragged about assaulting women. On Thursday, prosecutors played jurors a secret audio tape of Trump and his then-fixer, Michael Cohen, discussing a plan to pay off former Playboy model Karen McDougal to keep her silent about her affair with Trump. Police in Canada have arrested three Indian men suspected of assassinating the Canadian Sikh leader Hardeep Singh Nijjar outside a Sikh temple in British Columbia last year. Nijjar was a prominent leader in a movement to form an independent Sikh homeland in India. Last week, The Washington Post revealed senior members of India's spy agency were directly involved in a foiled plot to kill a prominent Sikh activist who lives here in New York City. And the acclaimed British-Palestinian surgeon, Ghassan Aboussita, was denied entry to France on Saturday, despite an invitation to speak to members of the French Senate about his time volunteering with Doctors Without Borders in Gaza. This comes weeks after Germany barred Aboussita from attending a Palestinian conference in Berlin. Germany's reportedly placed a one-year ban on Aboussita from entering any country in Europe's border-free zone. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's ordered 100,000 Palestinians living in eastern Rafah to evacuate ahead of an Israeli offensive on the southern Gaza city, where more than 1.4 million displaced Palestinians have sought refuge. This comes as Israeli authorities have taken Al Jazeera off the air inside Israel. On Sunday, police officers raided the network's Jerusalem bureau, seizing broadcasting equipment. Israel's Foreign Press Association called it a, quote, dark day for democracy. The move came just 2 days after World Press Freedom Day. Over the past 8 months, Al Jazeera has been one of the only international outlets with reporters on the ground inside Gaza. This is a pre-recorded video message by Al Jazeera's Imran Khan from East Jerusalem.
If you're watching this pre-recorded report, then Al Jazeera has been banned in the territory of Israel. On April the 1st, the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, passed a law that allowed the prime minister to ban Al Jazeera. He's now enacted that law. Let me just take you through some of the definitions within the law. They've banned our website, including anything that has the option of entering or accessing the website, even passwords that are needed, whether they're paid or not, and whether it's stored on Israeli servers or outside of Israel. The website is now inaccessible. They're also banning any device used for providing content. That includes my mobile phone. If I use that to do any kind of news gathering, then the Israelis can simply confiscate it. Our internet access provider, the guy that simply hosts AlJazeera.net, is also in danger of being fined if they host the website. The Al Jazeera TV channel, completely banned. Transmission by any kind of content provider is also banned. And holding offices or operating them in the territory of Israel by the channel. Also, once again, any devices used to provide content for the channel can be taken away by the Israelis. It's a wide-ranging ban. We don't know how long it'll be in place for. but it does cover this territory of the state of Israel. Imran Khan, Al Jazeera, occupied East Jerusalem.
Again, that's a pre-recorded video message by Al Jazeera correspondent Imran Khan from East Jerusalem. As the death toll in Gaza approaches 35,000, with more than 78,000 people wounded in Israeli attacks since October 7th, we're joined in Doha, Qatar, by Mohammed Mouawad, managing editor of Al Jazeera, joining us from the studios of Al Jazeera. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you start off by responding to Israel's move and what this means for Al Jazeera?
Thank you, Sami, for having me, and thanks for following this story. It's a series of intimidations that the Israeli government are placing on us, and this move is within the same loop of failure that the Israeli government have entered since the beginning of this war. First, they have intimidated us to try and stop the message, the coverage of Al Jazeera from inside Gaza. After they have failed, they shot the messenger, actually three messengers of Al Jazeera, three correspondents, and that did not stop our coverage. So now they are back again and trying to stop our coverage or try to delegitimize the coverage by saying that we don't operate in Israel. And we consider this an attack on the journalistic community in all, and we consider it a criminal act, because this is against and a violation, a clear violation to the international human rights laws.
Can you explain what happened this weekend? How you found out that Al Jazeera was banned, the raiding of your offices in Jerusalem? Describe the whole sequence.
If you go back like 3 months back, the Israeli government have been threatening Al Jazeera, intimidating Al Jazeera by saying that they are going to vote for a law to block Al Jazeera for 45 days under the umbrella of the emergency actions that they are taking because of the war, the ongoing war. So we've been hearing that, like our colleagues at Haaretz, who were threatened to be defunded because they are against the national security of Israel, as the Prime Minister Netanyahu's government stated. We've been hearing that they are going to put the vote for the cabinet to pass, and it took them 3 months up until yesterday. They have listed it on the top of the agenda of the government. They voted in favor anonymously, and the Minister of Communications took actions on the ground to block our coverage by seizing our signal with the cable companies in Israel and raiding our locations. They have raided a remote location, live position, where our colleagues at Al Jazeera English were broadcasting, and they have placed a blockade on our office in Jerusalem. And of course, this law is ambiguous. I mean, they can take actions as much as Prime Minister Netanyahu is concerned. They can do the same with our office in Ramallah in the West Bank, because they can say that this is under the umbrella of the emergency law.
Do you think that the banning starting this weekend, and can you explain, does this go for 45 days or is it indefinite? Do you think that there is a direct relationship between the banning of Al Jazeera, which is one of the few international news organizations that have journalists on the ground in Gaza, and Israel announcing and dropping flyers in southern Rafah telling people to leave because of an imminent invasion?
Of course, Amy, this move is politicized. I mean, anything taken against Al Jazeera is a politicization by the Israeli government and Prime Minister Netanyahu against a journalism organization, Al Jazeera. But for us, we consider it, part of a sequence of intimidations. We have three colleagues killed on the front lines, families targeted of our colleagues. And for us, we don't want to be dragged in the political realm. We prefer to be in the journalistic realm. But apparently, the Israeli government, for a country that's called itself a democracy, is taking the same actions that were taken against us back in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, when a bunch of authoritarian regimes banned Al Jazeera and closed our offices under the umbrella of violating or threatening the national security, which is a very ambiguous and baseless and unfounded claims. By the way, Amy, it is very important to mention that our coverage does include the Israeli side. We have, from the beginning, aired all the press conferences for the Israeli officials. While this might anger our audience, because they feel like this is uncomfortable for them to be watching the statements of the Israeli government, and at the same time we air all the atrocities happening in Gaza, but we are committed to the impartial coverage, and we continued that. So we consider all the events on the ground as events that we continue to cover from inside Gaza, but of course we cannot disconnect it from the fact that the Israeli government is trying to conceal what's happening in Gaza and try to intimidate Al Jazeera and block Al Jazeera's coverage and delegitimize the whole coverage by saying they don't operate in Israel. They are a one-sided kind of coverage. But we are committed to staying objective, and that's our goal and our ethic from code of ethics from the beginning of the launch of this organization in the Middle East 25 years back.
Today, Israel marked Holocaust Remembrance Day, the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. At a wreath-laying event at Israel's National Holocaust Museum and Memorial in Jerusalem, video shows Prime Minister Netanyahu being heckled with calls to resign. This is what happened.
יתכבד להזמין את ראש ממשלת ישראל, מר בנימין נתניהו.
Apparently, the protester said in Hebrew, quote, "We must not descend into the abyss again. What else is necessary for you to go home?" He said to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Your response, Mohammed Morwad.
Well, this is one of the events that Al Jazeera could have covered yesterday, but our correspondent wasn't able to reach the area because we abide by the laws. We don't want to violate it because our colleagues are operating under the Israeli law in Israel and in Jerusalem. Our colleague today appeared live from Ramallah, from the West Bank, where we moved all our colleagues there, and we covered these events remotely. Of course, we will keep the space for this kind of coverage, and we'll make sure that what's happening inside Israel is on our screen. But still, the one who is not, benefiting from that is the Israeli side. We want to stay impartial, but these kind of important events, the turmoil that Israel is going through, isn't. We're not able to cover like before after this decision.
The Israeli communications minister, Shlomo Karhi, said, "We finally are able to stop Al Jazeera's well-oiled incitement machine that harms the security of the country." Your response?
Of course, this is the same thing that we have heard before in the Middle East as well, when we get both sides to speak. I mean, the fact that they call the other party of the conflict bad people doesn't mean that a news organization won't deal with it. I mean, we report both sides. We have the Palestinian side and the Israeli side. We report both sides. And what the Israeli government is bragging about is trying to censor our coverage or try to intimidate us to have us not cover the other side of the story. We are committed to that. We're covering from Gaza with six correspondents on the ground. We are the only news organization on earth covering from north of Gaza. And we call all the international community to act, the journalistic community specifically, because up until now, we are 7 months in this war, and the atrocities happening in Gaza, and you don't have an international journalist entered Gaza because the Israeli government is preventing this from happening. So it's a strategy that the Israeli government is working upon from the beginning of the conflict, is try to make sure that the story doesn't reach the world. But guess what? Any reporting of Al Jazeera is cooperated by other news organizations. We get called up by ABC, CNN, NBC, all the news organizations around the globe to ask us to get the rights of the footage that we get from inside Gaza. And our reporting is the base for so many investigation reports that happened and that was broadcasted in so many channels around the globe.
We're talking to Mohammed Mouawad, Al Jazeera's managing editor, speaking from the studios of Al Jazeera in Doha. I wanted to ask you about the killings and woundings of journalists. This Saturday, May 11th, will mark 2 years since the Palestinian-American Al Jazeera Arabic reporter Shireen Abu Akleh was killed by Israeli gunfire while on assignment in the West Bank for Al Jazeera outside the Jenin refugee camp. Since October 7th, there have been reportedly over 50 attacks against Al Jazeera journalists. In December, Al Jazeera cameraman Samer Abu Dhaka was killed by an Israeli drone attack, as he reported in Khan Yunis. Longtime Gaza correspondent Wael al-Dadu was also injured in the attack. Then in January, his son, Hamza, also a journalist, along with videographer Mustafa Thurayo, were killed in an Israeli drone strike. I remember watching Al Jazeera that day when reporters at Al Jazeera in your studios in Doha held up signs of the killed and the injured. Mohammed Mouawad, can you respond to what the kind of toll that this attack on Gaza and, of course, in the case of Shireen Abu Akleh, that was 2 years ago in the West Bank, has taken on your staff, on your reporters, and beyond Al Jazeera, over, according to CPJ, Committee to Protect Journalists, over 100 media workers.
We remember Shireen Abu Akleh every day now with what's happening in Gaza and, the devastating loss of our colleagues on the front line. We remember Shireen Abu Akleh because now we understand that when the journalistic community and the international community let this go without holding the Israeli government accountable for this, the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, who was covering a war like what's happening in Gaza right now, but was covering an incident, an Israeli operation in Jenin, when the international community was silent, with this crime, then came other crimes and other crimes followed. So what we want right now is from the international community, the journalistic community, is to show strong actions against the Israeli government, place pressure for the United States. We are still waiting for a statement from the White House, from the State Department, to comment on what's happened with our offices in Jerusalem and Israel. This is very important right now. We haven't seen a statement yet. And this is very important for the United States, who, is talking about preventing, the harming of journalists around the globe and defending democracy. So we're still waiting for a statement from the United States. We call upon the international community to intervene because this is a kind of an intimidation to the whole journalistic community to try to make sure that Gaza story isn't out there in the world and try to make sure that we don't give voice to the voiceless. We report a one side only of the story from the Israeli side, and we don't talk about what's happening in Gaza.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, and condolences on the death of so many journalists at Al Jazeera. Mohammed Mouawad, we thank you so much for being with us, managing editor of Al Jazeera, speaking to us from Al Jazeera headquarters in Doha, Qatar. Coming up, as the World Food Program warns northern Gaza is experiencing a full-blown famine, we'll get a report from a doctor just out. Stay with us. Tormented Heart by Dalal Abu Amna. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue to look at the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. As the head of the World Food Program warns, northern Gaza is experiencing a full-blown famine, with severe starvation quickly spreading to the south due to Israel's war and total blockade of Gaza. World Food Program Executive Director Cindy McCain, the widow of the late Senator John McCain, spoke Sunday on NBC News Meet the Press.
There is famine, full-blown famine in the north, and it's moving its way south. And so with what we're asking for and what we've continually asked for is a ceasefire and the ability to have unfettered access to get in, safe and unfettered access to get into the into Gaza.
Human rights groups accuse Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war, a war crime. The Israeli military has repeatedly blocked the entry of vital aid into Gaza, attacked humanitarian aid convoys, and killed Palestinian civilians waiting to receive food and other aid. A Palestinian mother in Gaza City described the dire situation.
We need food to survive. We need to feed our children. We want to get to this area, but can't get there with cars because the roads are all blocked by rubble from the strikes. The sun hits us as we walk, and you find a long queue there from the morning, and you're exhausted by the time you return, all for some bread.
For more, we go to Amman, Jordan, where we're joined by Dr. Waleed Massoud, a vascular surgeon, board member of Palestine Children's Relief Fund. He headed PCRF's medical mission to Gaza earlier this month. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Doctor. If you can start off by describing what we're seeing. I mean, to have Cindy McCain, the head of the World Food Program, saying the North is in full-blown famine, describe the effects and what this means for the people who are surviving living in Palestine, Gaza.
Good morning, first of all. Good morning, America. First of all, let me say about PCRF that our mission is to provide a medical and humanitarian relief for the children throughout the Levant, regardless their nationalities or religion. We headed to Gaza under the umbrella of PCRF and the umbrella of WHO, okay? We had one lecture in the WHO in Cairo telling us about the safety measures, what we are going to meet in Rafah. Once we entered there, the moment we entered there, we could see the children around us begging for food, begging for money, begging for anything, okay? The starvation, you could see it in everywhere in the hospital. We were based in the European hospital, and in the buildings of the hospitals, it was full of refugees. More than 50,000 refugees came from the north to this hospital because they feel it is safe. It's not only in the territory around the hospital, but inside the hospital, inside the corridors, in the stairs, every room, they had refugees. While we were walking in the corridors, you could see the children around, and you could see by their eyes how they are underfed, and they have malnutrition, and they are starving. You could see how they lost the muscle mass. You could see the skin. You could see how they fatigue. You could see how they are depressed, actually. Yani, when you talk to them, they are slow motion in talking, okay? You can see the loss of the weight on these children. In the theaters, when we operate upon children, we could see how their body mass index is low. And we could see they are not oriented, actually, most of the patients upon we operated. This reflects this decrease the immunity of the children and increase the rate of the infection because there is no enough proteins in their body to initiate or to make the immunity system in the right way. We had to operate immediately as emergency on many injured patients, not only children, but also adults. Starvation does not only with the children. It was everyone in the population. Imagine you have 1.8 million in Rafah, and there is no enough food for these. If there is a food, they cannot even reach it because transportation is in dangerous. You could see how is the World Kitchen being bombed and killed there. What about the locals? If the foreigners died from bombarding their cars, what about the locals? You can imagine how 1.8 million, they don't have enough hospitals. Only three proper hospitals is working in Rafah. We operated in Rafah only, but some of our surgeons went to Al Kuwaiti Hospital because they could not transfer the kids to the European hospital. One of our surgeons, pediatric surgeons, went to the Al Kuwaiti Hospital and performed 16 surgeries. Totally, we operated around 250 or 75 and more. Situation was very bad in the theater. The staff, if we talk about staff are exhausted, staff depressed, staff disoriented. All the staff in the theaters and in the wards in the hospital, they are volunteers actually. They don't receive salaries. Do you know what they receive? They are volunteers working, no money, but they receive only the lunch. And this lunch, they eat a little bit. Maybe they eat 10% of their lunch in order to take the lunch to the tents, to their families, because they don't have money to buy anything. And if they have money, there is not enough food in the market. We operated upon children who been injured around 5-6 months ago. We had a patient, a 13 years old patient. I send you his video. He had shrapnels behind the knee, and he developed a fistula between the artery and the vein. So because of that, his foot and leg became ischemic, no enough blood, and it began a gangrene in his toes. So we did such an operation. This patient had a referral letter to go to Egypt for a treatment, but he could not because there is a queue. Maybe it will take him 10 months just to his chance to go to Egypt. We did the operation. We disconnected the fistula. And he is okay, but you could tell how his muscles are weak and there is a loss of muscle bulk with him. His wounds, we followed him a few days after that. His wounds is not healing well because of the lack of proteins in his body, lack of minerals, lack of vitamins in his body. There is no enough food even in the hospital to give them IV fluids or IV nutrients. Many patients died from infection. Because they don't have enough immunity, they don't have enough antibiotics or proper antibiotics, because sometimes they have the basics of the antibiotics. We managed to bring many medications, many antibiotics, other things, but it's not that enough. When a mission comes, they bring some, but it's not enough for 1.8 million people there in between. And there is, as you said earlier, above 78,000 injured. And injured patients. Our mission was depressing to us from inside, but we were happy to give what we can do to them. There were many things which disturbed us. We could work in an environment which is unsuitable. Okay. Example: these drones all the times have noise voices like zzz. That's what they called it Zannani. First 3 days in our team, they could not sleep because of this drones and Zannani and this noises, and it is 24 hours. There. We had the staff exhausted and depressed. When we came, we were seven surgeons from Jordan and one nurse also from Jordan. We had two from Ireland. We have one from Germany and one from United States. All of them, we gathered them. We could not eat full food. Because we feel we are guilty once we are eating, and outside there is a lot of children begging for food, and families maybe they don't eat at all or they eat one time a day. Many surgeries were done major surgeries. Which needs that this patient has should have feeding IV or something in order to his wounds to heal. We managed to help patients, but in some situations it is out of our hands to continue. Okay, I managed, for example, to reoperate the lab cath, the cath lab. So we can do some surgeries with interventional radiology. This cath lab was out of work for more than 7 months. We managed to start working on this. We did many surgeries, and the patient discharged them home. This is another point. When we did surgery, patient went to discharge. The patient said, "Where I am going? I don't have any home. I don't have even tent to go." So many patients stay in the hospital so they can have a home, shelter, they can have food also. We managed also, they have dialysis machines, which is out of work for the last 7-8 months in the European hospital. We managed with the help of one of the biomedical engineers who came from Jordan, Dr. Smadi, we managed to fix up these two machines, and we reopened the dialysis unit there. We tried to bring some medicine, some instruments, some tools, equipment to be used for the patient there, but that was not enough.
Dr. Massoud, I'm going to interrupt here because we have to break.
Our mission not only was
I know medical, that there is a delay.
We tried to support.
Dr.
Dr. Masood, there's a delay, but I just wanted to end by saying that we are seeing nonstop breaking news on Twitter now. For example, the New Yorker contributor Masab Abu Toha says the Israeli army is starting to blow up complete neighborhoods in East Rafah just 4 hours after ordering families to evacuate the area. And I wanted to end, we just have 30 seconds, because you work with Palestine children's relief, with your observation that increasingly children are expressing suicidal thoughts. We have 30 seconds.
Unfortunately, I had two patients, yani one patient and his sister. They were around 8 and 7 years. They were questioning me when I was in the round, why I am still alive while my wife, my mother and father and the brothers died. The children there, they started to think about suicidal attempts. And we have another patient who lost their legs and they lost all the family. And she is bedridden and she tried to attempt suicide. Children, I cannot imagine how they will grow, these children in the future, while they were thinking about suicidal attempts because their family has died. Unfortunately, many children thinking about this. I cannot imagine in the future how they will act and how they will look to the world and to the peace. Imagine what's happening. Each family has lost many of their main supporter as father or mother. This creates a psychiatric situation with these children. I think as they need a surgeon to be there, they need a psychiatrist to in order to treat these patients. It is in need, definitely in need, because the increase of the let us say not suicide, because I did not see any suicidal attempts, but I heard from many children they are thinking about suicide. Unfortunately, yani the help now is going through vascular surgeon, orthopedic surgeon, etc. I think we need to send more doctors there.
Dr. Waleed Masood, we're going to have to leave it there as we go to the students who are protesting across the United States. I want to thank you so much for joining us from Amman, Jordan, just back from Gaza, vascular surgeon and board member of the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. Coming up, the protests at University of Michigan graduation, at State University of New York, New Paltz, and more. Back in 20 seconds. By Pierce Bolton. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Graduation ceremonies have begun on college campuses across the United States as students continue their protests in solidarity with Palestine and calling on their schools to divest from Israel. On Friday, the student speaker at University of Toledo's graduate school commencement ceremony wore a keffiyeh hijab and a Palestinian flag over her graduation robe. This is part of the address by Maha Zaiden, a Palestinian-American graduating law student, president of the Graduate Student Association.
I apologize that this is not a typical graduation speech, but there is nothing typical about the times that we are living in. There is nothing typical about 15,000 children live-streamed deaths being watched. And there is nothing acceptable about our institutional complicity, silence, or the gross misuse of police force nationwide.
Maha Zeidan. Meanwhile, at the University of Michigan, students holding Palestinian flags briefly disrupted graduation ceremony Saturday as a plane flew overhead holding a banner that read, "Divest from Israel now, free Palestine." Also on Saturday at University of Virginia in Charlottesville, where in 2017 neo-Nazis chanted, "Jews will not replace us," police and riot gear stormed a Gaza solidarity encampment and arrested at least 25 student protesters. The raid came after The Intercept's Prem Thakur reported UVA, quote, appears to have unilaterally changed policy on tents to help justify calling upon the police to arrest protesters. Police have now arrested more than 2,500 students at pro-Palestine protests across the U.S. in the past 3 weeks, which includes 133 arrests on Thursday at SUNY New Paltz alone, where police violently raided a student encampment with batons and dogs. Well, we're joined by three guests from these schools. We're beginning in Southfield, Michigan, with Salma Hamami, a student at the University of Michigan who just graduated this past weekend. Salma's president of Students for Justice in Palestine chapter at the University of Michigan. Salma, can you describe the graduation ceremony on Saturday?
Hi. Yes. Thank you for having me. So the graduation ceremony on Saturday took place in the early morning with nearly hundreds and hundreds of students prepared to enjoy a celebratory moment. However, likewise, there are hundreds of students who are in the process of immense grief, given the ongoing genocide in Gaza and given the fact that the University of Michigan is funding a genocide. So students took it upon themselves to engage in protest at the ceremony, with nearly 100 students walking up and down the aisle, trying to rally for the university to heed our demands, considering that they have entirely ignored us for the last 7 months. As soon as the plane flew over with the banner, "Divest from Israel now, free Palestine," students jumped out of their seats carrying the Palestinian flag, walked throughout the aisles, and eventually the police pushed us towards the back and prevented further protesters from being able to join us in the graduation.
And the response of the overall crowd, I mean, there were tens of thousands of people there at University of Michigan graduation, Salma.
Yeah, there were certainly tens of thousands of people there. The stadium is one of the largest in the world. And as soon as the plane flew by with the banner calling for the university to divest, cheers erupted through the crowd as students stood up and held their Palestinian flags. You could likewise hear a mix of cheers and some fellow students nearby calling for the police to immediately arrest us, cursing us out, throwing racial slurs. However, students continued on and held the Palestinian flag very high up and joined very quickly with one another and only got louder as both the cheers and boos continued.
Very quickly, Salma, I'm curious. At the same time, you have a Gaza solidarity encampment on campus. Police have not been called in to raid that?
Yes. Surprisingly, police officers have not been called in to raid our encampment yet. We have faced quite a bit in regards to police brutality throughout the last 7 months. And as of right now, our best guess is due to the fact that every single time police suppression continues on the rise, students' power only grows in response. And so considering that the university would probably be very fearful of what would happen on campus if they were to engage in police violence again, witnessing what has happened in the past, students would only exemplify and amplify their solidarity. So it's more so a preventative cause. They're saying that they're trying to allow students to peacefully protest. However, every single time we have tried peacefully protesting in the past, demanding a meeting, they've arrested us several times, brutally beaten us to the floor, even ripping off students' hijabs in the process. So as of right now, the university, I think, is trying to wait it out and to wait for the students' energy to die down. However, it's only going to continue to grow.
Salma's joining us from Michigan. We're going now to Cady de la Cruz, an undergraduate student at University of Virginia in Charlottesville, arrested Saturday for participating in the pro-Palestine encampment, a senior scheduled to graduate in 2 weeks. Now, let's place this again. This is Charlottesville, where in 2017, scores of white men, mainly men, marched saying Jews will not replace us. This is during the Trump administration. If you can describe the arrest that took place, Kadi, police arresting 25 protesters, what happened?
Hi, good morning. So as you noted, the tent policy changed without notice at 11 a.m. On Saturday, and at noon, they deployed state troopers in riot gear. We immediately linked arms. We knew why we were there. We knew we weren't going to leave until they met our demands, and we felt strong. They stalled for 2 hours. The state police, the city police, the county police, the university police were all there. At least 100 cops, and we danced, and a huge crowd gathered around the encampment, supporting us as police tried to keep them from getting in, but people kept running actually past the cops to join us. There was so much solidarity. The crowd outside was almost louder than us. Eventually, the state troopers in riot gear did close in on us, a line of at least 40 of them, just a little bit longer than us, with shields. We were able to hold our ground until they started to spray huge clouds of chemicals at close range. When we ran back into the encampment to flush out our eyes and our throats, it was when we were separated and on the ground that they started to beat me down with their shields, drag my body with my clothes, and they sprayed us at close range with the chemicals. I saw the can close to my face. I had a friend who they ripped her goggles off and sprayed her. They took us somewhere where they had no medics and no water while we screamed in pain. They detained 26 of us for almost 9 hours with the chemicals still burning on our skins. I'm now banned from campus. They've given us no chance to get our belongings. I have no phone, no laptop, no wallet. I'm purely getting by on the generosity of my friends. And like you said, this is the same campus that knew that men with rifles, Nazis, white supremacists were coming and did not stop them. And none of those white supremacists are banned from campus.
Kadi, you're supposed to graduate in 2 weeks?
Yes.
You're risking so much to have protested right before spending years getting your degree. Why did you do it?
We had spent so many months pushing for divestment. We had had walkouts, like Salma was saying, like we had had walkouts. We had done so much. We had passed a referendum that got more votes in favor than even our entire student council election. And our administration refused to even comment on divestment. And even though I only have 2 weeks before I'm supposed to graduate, I actually started the encampment on my last day of classes and I ended up missing my classes. But even with 2 weeks left, all of us there felt like we have more time on our hands left on our timeline than the people in Gaza as we're watching them bomb Rafah. We had a vigil the night before they raided our encampment. And we felt so much strength in our escalation. We knew why we were there. We linked arms. We felt strong. We danced in front of that riot gear. We would hold it down for anything.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Kadi. And I want to now go to New York, to Ray Ferrara, who is with SUNY New Paltz at State University of New York at New Paltz at the Gaza Solidarity Encampment. Ray Ferrara, can you describe, I mean, you had a large number of students arrested, over 130?
The closest thing to an accurate number we have is 133. But it is most definitely more than that. That's the number that the DA is giving. But just our jail support resources have made it even more than that. We had about that many people at the encampment.
And very quickly, since we only have about 40 seconds, can you describe what happened? You had just put the encampment up when police moved in?
No, we set up our encampment on 1 p.m. on Wednesday, and it wasn't until about 10:40 p.m. on Thursday that the police raided us. This is after several failed attempts to negotiate with the university. Police raided us for over 3 hours. They knocked my friend unconscious. He now has a concussion. They knocked an 82-year-old woman unconscious. All of my friends have bruises. They have red marks on their hands from the zip ties. And then afterwards, they bulldozed all of our things.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Ray Ferrara, SUNY New Paltz Gaza Solidarity Camp participant and student at SUNY New Paltz. Cady de la Cruz, speaking to us from the University of Virginia, and Salma Hamami at the University of Michigan, graduates just graduated, president of SJP. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard joins us to share an on-the-ground perspective of what's happening on college campuses around the nation.
She's one of the leading litigators in defending protesters and winning numerous lawsuits.
We're also joined by Eleanor Stein, who was on campus at Columbia University during the 1968 protests.
Eleanor Stein is a terrific attorney in her own right, a friend of Michael Ratner's when they were both there in 68, and she's got a good memory.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. During the Occupy Wall Street protests of late 2011 and early 2012, the FBI treated the movement as a domestic terrorist threat. That was even though the Bureau acknowledged that organizers were calling for peaceful protests. Massive resources were deployed to track the movement, and FBI and counterterrorism agents around the country coordinated with local and federal law enforcement to track and gather intelligence, effectively serving as an arm for private business. Now, more than a decade later, college administrators are calling local armed police, summon riot gear, to arrest and in many instances brutalize hundreds of pro-Palestinian protesters in actions and encampments that are sweeping the nation. More than 1,000 protesters have been arrested over the last 2 weeks on campuses in states including Texas, Utah, Virginia, North Carolina, New Mexico, Connecticut, Louisiana, California, and New Jersey. At UCLA last week, after pro-Israel supporters carrying symbols of radical Jewish groups, not of student age, allegedly threw fireworks into a solidarity encampment, students defending the camp were attacked with stones and sticks. Yet after an hour of violence, police standing nearby and watching failed to intervene. Joining us to discuss these ongoing developments is attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund and its Center for Protest Law and Litigation in Washington, D.C. Mara is one of the country's top litigators defending protesters and winning several reforms in police practices at mass assemblies and demonstrations. Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Mara, as you know, back in the 1960s, city police were called in on many college campuses to intervene during protests. And that led to brutalization and, in some cases, even death of student protesters. Now, as a result of that, nearly every college campus has its own police force. Why, then, are local law enforcement agencies being called on to deal with the rash of campus protests?
Well, universities across the United States are demonstrating their true colors when it comes to academic freedom and free speech, all the things that they talk to their students about in their classes, but then in practice, they're crushing student demonstrations, peaceful protesters demanding divestment from genocide and apartheid. And they are unleashing their municipality police departments to use the force of the state, to use the force of the municipalities to bring in police who are armed, who have guns, who have stun grenades, who have handcuffs, so that they can take students out of these peaceful encampments and take them into custody and crush the protests. And we're seeing a massive wave of that right now.
Mara, in last week's UCLA case, police stood by for an hour as pro-Israeli factions threw stones, sticks, and fireworks into a peaceful encampment. What does this say to you?